Hello everyone, this is Hartmut Schumacher from the podcast Go Your Own Path. In this episode, I want to introduce you to someone who has been going really his own path. It is Robert Zickler, the voice of whiskey, organizes whiskey events, mixology presentations, and educational seminars in order to introduce people to all things of whiskey. Trained in all aspects of the category by experts at some of the world's most famous distilleries, Zickler enjoys bringing whiskey to the people and converting enthusiasts one dram at a time. Before his career in whiskey, Robert taught literature and composition. His passion for wine and spirits prompted him to change course. He became a passionate veteran for the wine and spirits industry, crafting cocktails, studying wine, hosting spirited dinners throughout the land before becoming a master of whiskey for international drinks company Diageo. As master of whiskey, Zickler studied in renowned distilleries. He has also visited dozens of additional distilleries to strengthen his understanding for the distillation process. His extensive knowledge of whiskey enabled him to thrive as a leading brand ambassador and valued educational resource for distributors, consumers, and trade in Ohio, West Virginia, Colorado, Missouri, Oklahoma, Arkansas, New Mexico, and Kansas. In 2015, Robert formed the Voice of Whiskey, a whiskey event and consulting company. As Voice of Whiskey, he engages with bar owners and managers, food and beverage directors, chefs and restaurateurs on menu development, mixology, spirits, education, and event marketing. He also hosts exclusive events, offers advice on product development and evaluation, conducts product reviews, and is available for media presentations and public appearances. Zickler also instructs the Whiskey Ambassador Program, the UK's only accredited training course about whiskey. It is a fun and interactive training program designed for professionals who work in hospitality and spirits industry. The program gives staff and salespeople the knowledge, skills, and confidence to talk to customers about Scotch whiskey, leading to a better customer experience and increased sales. Upon completion of the written and practical exam, participants receive a Whiskey Ambassador Certificate and badge to showcase their achievement. When he's not bringing whiskey to the people, Robert enjoys expanding his culinary prowess in the kitchen. He incorporates his knowledge of international cuisine and proclivity for unique flavor combinations to create food and drink pairings that transform hearts, minds, and palates, at public and private spirited dinners. His fondness for herbs, spices, and exotic botanicals is also translated into innovative cocktails at his events that participants describe as both approachable and unforgettable. Robert's fondness for worldly libation and global cuisine inspired him to join forces with partners Noah Price and Thomas Merrill to establish a whiskey and rum cocktail bar and food truck pod, showcasing whiskey and rum cocktails and gourmet goodies. The bar, Finn's Manor, opened in September and will feature a series of ongoing spirited events and classes for the public and trade. The cocktails will pay homage to Scotland, the Caribbean, Southeast Asia, and New Orleans, places which have inspired Robert throughout his food and drinks journey. And today, he is also the host of the podcast Raise Your Glass, which will explore the world of artisanal beverages, discussing their origins, applications, and relevance with fellow professionals and enthusiasts. Hi, Robert. Welcome to my show, my friend.
Good day, my friend. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a wonderful sunny day here in Germany. and I just came from a very good restaurant. For this reason, I'm in a good mood, as it is for a guest after being in a good restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing, topics what you have made, especially as you were taught literature and composition, which is completely art. Yeah. And I think the finer things in thinking and hearing, and you put this knowledge into food and into spirits. Is that so? Is that correct? How would I say this?
I think what would be accurate is to say that teaching drove me to drinking.
Yes, I understand. That's great. Yeah, that's great. The situation is, how did you, for example, you worked as a teacher, so you have learned also teaching English and compositions.
Correct. I was an English teacher for approximately 10 years, both in the United States as well as in the Czech Republic.
And you really came back from Czech Republic to United States, in this wonderful city.
It was a lovely, lovely city. And my time there was amazing. I encountered some really lovely people, was completely, utterly enthralled by the architecture, just the culture in general. It was a really lovely experience. And it did suck to leave, but I had reasons why I had to return, regrettably. But yeah, man, it was a wonderful, wonderful time living there.
And I know that Prague is also very famous for their food and for their restaurants and the quality they offer.
There were so many amazing places to grab, you know, an authentic Czech meal, and always, you know, the quintessential local beer. They had a lot of different local beers available, and the beauty is they were all amazing. So you kind of just drank whatever fit the occasion or your mood or your, you know, particular palate craving that day. But yeah, you know, I wouldn't say the cuisine is like on the level of Vietnamese and Indian and, you know, Creole, but it's got its merits. It's, you know, rooted in a similar way to German cuisine, really. There's a lot of sausage, a lot of schnitzel type stuff cooked with meat stocks and gravies and dumplings and noodles, which are all, of course, great for those cold winter months. So it makes sense that that's, you know, a big part of their cuisine, but not the best stuff to eat in the middle of the summertime, mind you. But yeah, you know, there was some really good food there. And unfortunately, when I was there, this was back in 96, 97, there wasn't a whole lot of food outside of Czech to enjoy. I remember there was a really good Indonesian restaurant on one part of town, and there was a couple Chinese restaurants, but they were pretty dreadful. And then there was one American place, quote unquote, that did quote unquote barbecue, but it was more ketchup basted meat than it was actual barbecue. But anyway, outside of that, the food was really cool there, and I got to, you know, taste what really fresh homemade sausage tastes like. And they do their own version of Sauerbraten. I can't remember what it is. That's really
but,
nice.
But I see when you were 1960-97 in Prague, this is 6 years after the falling of the wall in Germany. So this means there was the transformation from a communist regime to capitalism, and this was a very tough time. So it was not the Prague what we know today.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, it was interesting because there were two kind of dichotomies occurring. There was the optimism and the excitement of new opportunity from a lot of the youth that could not wait to launch their own entrepreneurial endeavors. But then you had, you know, the upper middle age and the elderly folks that were completely confused and traumatized by this whole new system that they had no grounding in any longer. And you know, some of these older folks didn't know what was to come next, if they had homes, if they didn't have homes. So yeah, it was an interesting, interesting situation to observe and to hear the insights from all sides of the situation, because I had my students came from a multitude of ages. I had younger people, but most of them were older because they were primarily air traffic controllers. So these were people from the Czech Republic and some of the other Eastern Bloc countries who, you know, had been working as in their careers for some time. So I had everyone from the 30s into the 60s. And then my landlords were even older than that. And they had experienced, you know, the wretched times with the Nazi invasion. And then you talk to the middle-aged people, they experienced the Russian invasion. And it was just all these different perspectives. And I think all the shit that the Czechs went through made them a very skeptical people. Yep. But at the same time, you know, very cerebral, very intellectual, not easily duped or bullshitted, you know. And so the thing that's nice about the Czechs is when they show you warmth and they show you hospitality and a smile, it's really genuine. Like, it's really coming from a real place. There's nothing superficial about it. If they don't like you, they're certainly not going to pretend to like you for some bullshit cultural norm. It's just not the way they're operated. And they're very kind people. They're very, you know, very sweet people. Once they get to know you and once you're on equal footing and they like you and you like them, then it's amazing at how far they'll go out of their way to accommodate you in times of need, for instance, you know, that you don't see. You know, like in America, we always joke that if you want to see how good of a friend somebody is, ask for their help moving and see how quickly they'll come, you know, to assist.
You're on the way.
Yeah. And so I remember one time I was moving from one part of the city to the other, and I made mention of it to my class just in passing. And I had like 10 people offer to help me, and they meant it on a Saturday, you know, and Czechs really value their weekends. A lot of times they go out to their cottages on the weekends and enjoy nature, and they don't want to hang around the city. They want to get the hell out. And I had all these people offering to help me who I barely knew, just out of the kindness of their hearts. So yeah, there were some great people. Okay. And it was a good time, and God damn, the beer was amazing. Really, really amazing beer. And I even gained an appreciation that I did not have before for Moravian wine and Bohemian wine. And it was, yeah, it's very different than your Greek and your Spanish and Italian and French, but I accustomed my palate to it, and I enjoyed a fair share of it as well as the beer.
Okay. And I understand, because if you're, for example, I say it straight, normally, for example, we here in Europe, we also have our thoughts concerning Americans, and we are very happy when they come and live here, because this makes a small transformation. and when you came back, went directly in the wine industry, or what did you? Because I think at the moment I see, okay, you were in Czech Republic, you were an English teacher, you worked in bars besides, but then you left, and then you went back to the States, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So basically the entire time I taught, I was moonlighting as a server or as a bartender just to make ends meet, just because, I mean, the honest truth is the salary for a teacher is a true insult to the amount of work and time and effort that these folks put in on a daily, weekly basis. And it's not just during the school year, like some people think. They have to take courses. A lot of times they're actually teaching summer school during their so-called summer break. They're having to, like I said, take classes to keep their certification current. Many of them tutor on the side. So it's not a posh job. And my God, the way society is going, it's increasingly difficult because they're doing so much more in the classroom on a daily basis than just educating. They're acting as coaches and career, you know, guides, and they're acting as psychologists, and some of them are acting as, you know, some of the things that teachers witness that kids are going through today are unlike we've ever seen in human history. And there's a lot of weight to that, that a lot of people underestimate. And it's why a lot of teachers burn out and leave the profession. So anyway, I enjoyed my time. I taught in a couple different places. I started off in Tampa where I graduated, and then I took the job in the Czech Republic. And when I came back, I taught for a few more years I was in Florida briefly. And then it was during a summer when I was obviously not in the classroom and I was looking for work to keep the revenue coming in and paying the bills. And so I was looking for some bartending gigs during the summertime, and a friend of mine who had worked for several years in the wine and spirits distribution industry kept urging me to give that world a try. And although the idea of going around to different restaurants and tasting their buyers on wine and meeting with their chefs and tasting them on wine and figuring out food pairings and cool dinners to host and, you know, things that motivate people who are fans of the senses and fans of food and drink, etc., it all sounded appealing. But the thing that I really did not want to have to do is try to push people to buy things. I've never been a big fan of the salesman aesthetic at all. Like, it's just something, it's a skillful endeavor, and people who are good salespeople are really effective at a lot of different industries in this world, and it's a particular skill set that I certainly admire, but it's not something that I ever wanted to step into and attempt to do myself. It just wasn't me. And then he told me, well, look, man, you know, what you're doing is you're sharing your passion and love for particular wine and spirits with people. You're telling them how it could benefit them to have this and benefit their guests who are coming in to experience it. So at the end of the day, if you're, quote, selling something that you actually believe in, you're really not selling it as much as you are sharing it. And if you're true and you're honest in your, you know, day-to-day pursuits, it'll just come natural and people will respond to you and they'll resonate with you and you'll do well. And I was like, that sounds a little fucking hokey, but all right, I'll give it a go. And he was certainly right. It came naturally because I was already used to, you know, deadlines and tracking, you know, progress and reports and all that from the educator standpoint. And then I'd already waited tables and bartended for several years, so I was very familiar with the restaurant world and very comfortable in that arena. And so just merging the two came very effortlessly to me. And after a few years of doing that, I was recruited to become a master of whiskey, which was a regional brand ambassador role for Diageo, representing their rather diverse whiskey portfolio. And so I started off in kind of the Midwest area, representing Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, Western Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. And then after doing that for a few years, I was promoted to a role in Colorado. And so I stayed in Colorado for another 5 years or so. And then there were a lot of developments that took place along the way, and the kind of the responsibilities and the expectations and the management of the role altered dramatically from the way it was when I started. And it just became not quite as enjoyable as it once was. And sure. I realized.
So it's not so good anymore to work in this industry.
No, not at all. It's become far, I don't know, a lot of the joy was sucked out of the role. And instead of a knowledge education resource, the role became more just a glorified salesperson with an expense account. And the quality of the dinners you hosted anymore didn't matter. The quality of the events that you hosted or the staff trainings where you won brand loyalty from certain people in the ideal demographic that they were so desperately trying to obtain, preference list for life, suddenly didn't matter anymore. What mattered is how many cases you could commit to being sold to said account, or how many features were placed. And all this stuff is superficial at the end of the day. Like, you can print out phony features left and right. Sales reps do it all the time to get money on incentives they're being offered, but you don't really win genuine brand loyalty from anybody without an authentic relationship being built. And that relationship often comes from an authentic human-to-human interaction where you open up somebody's palate, you engage their senses, you instill new knowledge about a category, and they taste this stuff, and kind of this aha moment triggers where they didn't think they liked this particular category of spirit, say Scotch whiskey, but then they taste it with the right food paired with it, and they're hooked for life, and they never forget that experience.
I understand directly. Directly. You need to get a specific taste of the whiskey, and then you're addicted, because the most, well, I don't want to mention it, JW, yeah?
JW, Johnny Walker?
Yes.
That's who I worked for.
Really?
Yeah, the House of Walker. That, all those independent single malts that you saw, the Craganmore, Oban, Lagavulin, Kalila, Cardew, those are all single malts that are under the House of Walker. And one of the reasons that Johnny Walker is able to make such extraordinary blended whiskeys is because they have this stable of single malts that's second to none. They have some of the best whiskey stocks in all of Scotland. And, of course, expert blenders, which certainly makes a difference as well.
Well, then I will say it politely. There's a big difference between the Johnny Walker I buy in the store. And
Well, the red label, sorry, Diageo, if this offends you, but the red label is fairly mediocre. The black is, as far as I'm concerned, a fantastic.
Yes, blended. Yes, the black is wonderful.
Wonderful.
That's correct. Yeah.
In fact, I've been asked before, I don't know if that's still the case at all, to be quite candid, but there were a number of years where people would ask me, what would your desert island be, your desert island whiskey be? And I would say Johnny Walker Black Label, because it's got just enough fruit and floral notes and just enough of the peat and the smoke and the more substantive, complex weight and character that you want. So, like, it was a revelation to me the first time I was in Puerto Rico. I had Johnny Walker Black Label with coconut water, and it was perfect. It was the perfect friggin' drink. I still enjoy it from time to time. And it was something that I never thought would be even conceivable. You're putting coconut water in scotch. That's ludicrous. But the coconut water pulls out the vanilla notes that, of course, come from the former bourbon casks that the whiskey's aged in. And then the creaminess of the coconut water balanced with the smokiness of the peat and the whiskey just makes this perfect, perfect beverage. And it changed my, and something like that makes you instantly step out of the perception of whiskey as always having to be some kind of elegant, debonair, high society shit, because while a lot of people approach certain things to show off some degree of success or whatever the hell you want to call it, there's certain drinks people aspire toward drinking because it's image involved, let's face it. And Scotch whiskey is certainly one of those, but when you go to Scotland and you sit down with the fellows and the gals who make this stuff and the people who work, you know, in the warehouses and the people who manage the barrel houses, there is not a pretentious bone in their body. They're salt of the earth, farmer folk, most of them. Some of them are, you know, come from educated families, but most of them are, they're really upper, they're like blue collar to middle class people who are very genuine, very heartfelt. They love what they do. They don't turn their nose up at anyone else's product. They kind of, they're in an industry, and it's an industry that all of these people are grateful for having in Scotland. And you don't, it gives you a completely different angle in how you look at whiskey when you taste it with the people who actually make it and live it daily, rather than the little poser pedestrian bozos across the pond that are trying to look sophisticated. Like one time, I'll tell you a funny story. I was in this nightclub in Denver, and I just left an event, and these people wanted to go have a couple drinks, and I said, all right, fine. And I got dragged into this nightclub wearing a fucking kilt, which was always interesting. Not that I lack the slightest bit of confidence in wearing my kilt anywhere and everywhere, but it's not something you wear to a nightclub. That's just a little ludicrous, especially in formal Highland attire, which is what I was wearing. But I went in anyway, and of course a lot of heads turned, but it wasn't exactly anything shocking, because people in Denver aren't uptight, delusional idiots. They're not going to be shocked by that. But long story short, I walked by this crowd of these little mindless ingrates that are standing around a bottle of Johnny Walker Blue Label that's in this ice bucket, and they've got these snifters sitting out, and they're not even drinking it. They're just standing there posing like soulless, mindless idiots, thinking they're impressing some vapid little bimbos walking by because they have a bottle of Johnny Blue Label with them. Like, seriously, is that what the category's come to? Give me a break. So anyway, yeah, what I was trying to say is that whiskey does not have to be pretentious. You know, there does not have to be a specific way in which you enjoy it. One of the things I always used to say to people is, you know, I'd have this giant audience and I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, there's only one true way to drink whiskey. And I'd hold up my Glencairn glass with the whiskey and the room would freeze. And I'd say, however you like. And they'd all laugh with, like, you know, this laughter because and relief. And really it's the case. I mean, if you want to properly give a sensory evaluation of a whiskey, there is a way to do that. And that is tasting it neat, adding a few drops of water, tasting it again, maybe even more water, until you can lower the proof to such a point that your palate is able to obtain the maximum aroma and bouquet that you can obtain from the whiskey to give the proper sensory notes. But when you're talking about enjoyment, drink it however the hell you like. If you like it on the rocks, if you like it on one cube, or you like it on the rocks with a splash of soda or ginger beer or even Coke, you might have a really shitty palate if you put Coke with your whiskey, but that's just my opinion. However the hell you want to drink it, really, drink it. I mean, I do think putting something like Coca-Cola on a Scotch whiskey is fucking ludicrous. I really do. I have to say that. But this again reminds me of a story where I was hosting a Bushmills luncheon here in Denver, Colorado, and Colm Egan, the master distiller from Bushmills, was there. And it was a great dinner. I'm not certain where it is. No, I think it was at Vesta Dipping Grill, which is a wonderful Denver institution that just closed because of the response to this fucking situation. But very sad loss of a really timeless, wonderful food and drink establishment. But anyway, we did this tasting, and this bartender raised his hand, and he said, Colm, how does it make you feel that you go through all the time and effort to source this beautiful barley you put it through fermentation, you put it through distillation, it comes out of the still heathery and floral and gorgeous, and you lay it down to wood to allow that conversation with oak to begin, where it evolves into this complex, mature, elegant being. And you take it out of the barrel and you put it in a beautiful bottle and you ship it across the pond, and somebody pours it on ice and dumps a bunch of ginger ale all over it. And he says, I feel great. I hope they like the drink, and I hope they go and buy a bottle of it afterwards.
That's great. One question, are there still many independent small distilleries on the market, or is there only one or two or three big distilleries who have bought them all?
That is a very good question. Things have changed dramatically in the last 10 to 20 years. There was a period where all of these multinational companies were gobbling up all these small distilleries. And it came to a point where there were very few independent Scotch distillers left. Glenfarclas is one of them. And things have changed in the last 10 years. A plethora of brand new distilleries is popping up all over Scotland. I actually flew to Scotland last year with a friend of mine, Clark, who's starting his own whiskey company soon, to visit all of these new distilleries. It was a whirlwind of a trip. We went to like 12 different distilleries in a week. It was madness, but well worth it. Met some wonderful people, and any time in Scotland is a good time. But there's also a ton of brand new distilleries popping up in Ireland, and there are hordes of them in the United States. So there's a big, big wave of brand new independent distilleries, and I'm very concerned for them right now, because all of the financial assistance from, you know, world governments is coming to support, of course, the big dogs. None of these small independent folks are getting any help at all, and it's outrageous.
Ouch.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to force somebody to close their business for several months, force them to have no revenue, no way to pay their employees, no way to pay their debtors, and yet give them nothing in return. It's absolutely nuts. It's criminal. And I can't say how offensive I find it.
Luckily, here in Germany, in Hamburg, for example, we had a very famous steakhouse, and this went bankrupt, and now the owner makes a lawsuit against the city because of the regulations. Only just so. So these people start to fight back. Yeah. But
yeah.
The question is mostly too late, because then it is already closed. And this is sad, because it's the variety of all these distilleries what is essential in this market, because this makes it very personal. For example, it's the same here in Germany. We had here in Germany, in close to Nuremberg, there's a city, and the city has the most breweries in whole Germany, and they have to close now, because they are independent, and they don't want to sell it to the big one, yeah, because then you can take direct toilet water. But this is my opinion, and so they close, and it's and we have here also so many beer. In Germany, this is nice to see how it was, and I feel the future where you get only one or two beers and that's it. Yeah.
And the sad thing is, there's a lot of soulless, mindless idiots who would have no problem with that whatsoever, and fuck every one of these people.
Yes.
Fuck them.
Me.
Low level.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
But this, what I would like to know also about the ambassador, you're a whiskey ambassador, and you also teach students to become whiskey ambassador. it sounds weird, but I personally got interested. How long would it take such a study, or how long does it take to go to the school and become a whiskey ambassador, and how much do a student has to pay?
Well, there are numerous whiskey accreditation programs out there. The the Whiskey Ambassador is an official accredited one out of Scotland, and it gives one, I would not say that it gives you the true competency of being a whiskey expert, but I think an ambassador could certainly be an adequate descriptor. It's a full 8 week course, or 8 week, I'm sorry, 8 hour course, where you go over the history of distillation in Scotland. You talk about the regionality of Scotland, all the different types of distilleries and the regional profiles that one tends to encounter. You talk about the distillation process itself, and you know, the relevance of peat to the flavor of whiskey and barrels, what type of wood gives what type of sensory notes to the whiskey and color. And we talk about the cocktails that incorporate Scotch whiskey. And we also touch on world whiskey from different parts outside of Scotland. But you have to bear in mind, the course was originally created to give Scottish individuals in the licensed trade essentially the competency, the comfortability, and the awareness of their own local liquid to be able to confidently sell this stuff to tourists coming into all of their different venues, as well as the locals as well. And so it's Scotch whiskey heavy, which I prefer anyway, so it was the perfect avenue for me to go. And I would say that it gives one a definite, solid awareness and assessment of the category of Scotch whiskey. And I think it's worth every penny that one pays for it. But there are courses that go even deeper. If you really want to go deep, there's additional courses I can talk to you about afterwards. But the Scotch Whiskey Ambassador is great for a newcomer, for sure. And I understand we are working on a deeper, more geeky level of course as well, kind of for the more advanced, that goes a little more into the chemistry aspect of it. So I don't know when exactly that's going to be released, but I know it's in the works.
Okay. This is very interesting. It sounds for me, it sounds like a good retirement job. For example, if you don't want to retire, then you open a good whiskey shop.
Yeah. Well, I certainly tend
cigars,
to like
that's it. Whiskey and cigars, and that's it.
Sure. Yeah, Latino older men might do a rum and cigar shop. You know, you see a lot of that in like South Florida, and
this is
they're happy as a clam. You know, smoking.
I believe this. This was directly my opinion. This was directly my impression. Instead of sitting at the bench in the garden, you sit at in your shop having the shop full of whiskeys and full of cigars, and then have a happy life if someone is coming, and then you sell some.
Yeah. Why not?
Cool. Yeah. No, it's, yeah, sounds.
Well, honestly, some of the best whiskey ambassadors that I've seen are older folks. I mean, not that they have to be old folks. Young people do a brilliant job at it as well. But I mean, when you see an older bloke, you know, in a kilt, people just tend to lift their ears a little wider to hear what they're saying than you're, you know, some whippersnapper in a suit that's talking about whiskey, you know.
Okay.
But I've seen every walk of life do wonderfully well at the ambassador world, and people, you know, shatter conventions all the time. Like,
yeah. You gave me another inspiration, Robert. Thank you very much.
The key to being a good ambassador, Harmut, is passion. If you have passion, everything else comes into play, and you can't speak passion.
And this is the reason why I'm asking, because my first whiskey when I was 15 years old was Glen Grant.
There's far worse whiskey. That's not a bad whiskey.
No, it's not a bad whiskey.
At all. No, it's quite nice. Yeah.
It's quite nice. It's a whiskey from the store, but it's a good one.
And yeah, mine was Seagram 7. Anything but refined. But I've had worse. yeah, if my first single, or if my first whiskey was a single malt, I'd be a lucky fellow. For sure.
That sounds really cool. And but then you stopped this selling business, and then you established your own bar in Denver, Colorado.
Yes, that is correct.
And since when you have established it, when you opened it?
Approximately 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. I work with some of the coolest human beings in the universe, and all of our collective energy tucked into this intriguing little piece of property has been a wonderful experiment, and soul and human connectivity and unbridled joy. Until, of course, recently, where everything is weird as fuck and getting stranger by the moment.
I see.
Yeah.
And you sent me also some pictures, and I see that there's a really, your bar has more of Jamaica feeling than anything.
Shantytown vibe on the outside, for sure. And then on the inside is the mystical dark manor, Finn's Manor. The way I describe it is Huck Finn basically got in a riverboat from New Orleans, left the Mississippi, and visited every port throughout the globe, and came back to open a manor here in Denver. Why not New Orleans? I don't know, but hey, we're in Denver. So he came to Denver and opened his manor with all the spirits he got from all the different port cities, and then opened food trucks from all the different port cities. So we had, you know, Jamaican food truck outside at one point, a Puerto Rican food truck, a Thai food truck, there's a Middle Eastern food truck, a pizza food truck, different types of sandwiches, everything under the sun. We had all different types of rotating food trucks. So different, some kick-ass stunning barbecues, some bao buns, everything you can imagine we had at different points. And a wide plethora of different styles and genres of music, nothing cookie cutter bullshit pop music, vapid idiocy, but like music with a soul, music that, you know, ignites your inner being, whether it's Tito's amazing flamenco style guitar and North African style guitar that he goes off on from time to time, or the Mile High Brass Band, which brings New Orleans style brass music that just lights up the entire vibe of the place. And of course we had LC and his people doing Afro-Cuban jazz every Sunday for a long time, which was really remarkable and created a really lovely vibe for a patio sipping Sunday with this amazing, you know, live music with bongos going and excellent, you know, fucking Cuban vibes in the middle of Denver, Colorado. It was really lovely. And then of course my bartenders, several of them are passionate DJs of their own right, so they bring their equipment in and, you know, spin certain nights. Each one of them would have their own evening and they would focus on their own interests and genres, and the music was always different, and sometimes we'd have one type of music on the inside and one type of music on the outside, so people could drift back and forth to whatever
I see,
you know, was resonating with them best. And a lot of laughter, a lot of joy, a lot of happiness. And now, you know, suddenly everybody must be seated. Nobody can be standing.
Yeah, it looks like a small town of Henry Morgan, who was this famous pirate, but also the inventor of the social system.
Yeah, man, when you can't sit at the bar and look longingly at the 800 plus bottles that we have in beautiful candlelight and music playing and talk to the bartenders and ask their opinions what direction you should go for this and that beverage, for this or that cocktail or this or that neat, and you don't get that social interaction and that engagement, and you're not sitting next to people talking and sharing your sensory experiences and just being humans and fucking talking, it's a it's a completely watered down, hollow experience. It's completely different. And so my people are having a hard time of it, but they're fucking rock stars. They're not complaining. They're not whining. They're following by all the little policies completely and just hoping, hoping, hoping for the time.
What is the situation at the moment in the U.S.? What is the situation at the moment? Is there, do you have the intent, do you think they are going to make a second lockdown, or do you think that at the moment they will go like it is at the moment?
Well, if they follow the instructions of the little cretin piece of shit individuals who launched this initial approach to handling the crisis, then yes, we will definitely go on a second lockdown, because that's in the papers that they published 10 years ago, their full intention to do so. I hope that our governor has the ethics and integrity and conscience to not go that route, because enough of small independent business owners in America and Colorado have been sufficiently fucked by this situation that there's no need to go that route. And I think that at some point people need to speak about the importance of individuals with compromised immune systems being brave enough to stay home.
And is your governor a Democrat or Republic?
He is a Democrat.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I've seen the best and the worst of both parties in response to this. But yeah.
Okay. And well, yeah, the situation is at the moment really not good at all. Also for many restaurant owners here in Germany and well, all over the world, it's crazy. And all the socializing is nearly stopped. And the situation is, the question is, how can we do socializing under this rules, which is nearly impossible. But do you think there is a possibility also from the cost also for doing these things at home, for example, that how can I say, you have a home service for pizza? Yeah. Do you think it's possible that people are going to,
ask a
bartender to come to them and to make some good drinks?
Well, it's already happening. There's rave parties here that are epic, that are underground. So all of the young kids, you know, in their 20s are going to these underground rave parties that are, you know, completely not listed anywhere on social media. So there's no ability to track them. And their life goes on, you know, so, and I give mad props and kudos to all of them. If I was 20 something and told I couldn't go out and dance and fucking drink and meet people my age to, you know, connect with on whatever level that might be, platonic or in the bedroom, I would tell them to go fuck themselves and find my own way to hang as well. So that's what they're doing. I was never a fan of raves myself because I thought the music sucked donkey dick, but I went to my fair share of them, and sometimes I had a good time. But whatever the case might be, when you take away people's fundamental human rights, they're going to find another avenue in which to connect with people. And if that's underground, then that's what it'll be, and good on them. That's all I have to say. So but in the meantime, we have people's livelihoods and businesses being closed left and right, and that doesn't stop people from living at all. All it does is gut a society's very culture, because I don't know, you tell me what a city is worth to anybody if there's nowhere to get a beautiful craft cocktail or elegant glass of wine and mingle with fellow people, if there's nowhere to go in and see an amazing jazz performance you know, before you, or there's nowhere to go see live salsa in front of you, or a singer-songwriter performing, or there's nowhere to go where you can see theater, and there's nowhere to go where you can enjoy, you know, a beautiful meal that's prepared by, you know, a French-trained chef that's lived in Southeast Asia and also lived in Africa and brings this wide assemblage of unique food to this, you know, elegant dish that they're putting in front of you. What's the point? What's the point in being in a city?
This is you're describing GDR until 1989. German Democratic Republic of 98 until 1989. This is how it looked like, yeah.
Yeah, without all of that, then that entire urban jungle is a concrete mess of nothing.
Yes. And the service in the restaurants were also not good because everyone was paid equal for doing the job or not.
Yeah, I noticed that when I got to the Czech Republic. The whole notion of hospitality had not yet entered their reality. It was like you could sit for 20 minutes before you would be acknowledged. That is unheard of here, I could say, thank God. But although I have witnessed it a few places, Denver's particularly good at giving shitty service. I don't know what's up with that, but we've got a special knack for that here. But something you'll never see in New Orleans, I'll tell you that. They take service like on a much higher level than many places.
Where? In Ireland?
New Orleans.
New Orleans, okay.
Yeah, New Orleans are very, and that's another place that is very near and dear to my heart that is going through a great deal of turmoil because almost their entire revenue stream for that city comes from tourism, and tourists come to New Orleans for food and drink and music. And all of those artists that don't have any money coming in, all of those waiters, all those busboys, all those chefs, cooks, servers, you know, all the ladies that work in hotels have no, you know, this affects so much more than just the restaurateurs. It's their entire supply chain, the entire supply network. And all of these arrogant little piece of shit human beings that have their money coming in for their mobile job at home, so they can sit on a high horse and just fucking snidely write off all of these other people that are in a world of shit, are really deplorable human beings. And at some point, people need to think about everyone.
You can see it in Seattle and Chicago, where they're in the autonomous zones. And the autonomous zones are remembering me about Nicaragua, because if you don't have any employment, if you don't have any job, then there are only three or four kind of businesses you can do. This is kidnapping, blackmailing, murder, and drugs.
Yeah, that's anywhere.
Yeah. These are the basic jobs, and if there is something else, the funny thing is in this country, the people, if they would have another chance to make a normal job, they would do it. But they can't because there is nothing.
Yeah. Exactly. And I don't care whether you're whatever part of the world you're from. When all ability to make money is stripped from you, then you're going to go to desperate measures to feed your family. That's human nature. And we're in a situation right now where all of the government assistance that was being given out over the course of the last several months has ran dry as of a few weeks ago. And you're going to have, there's millions, and there's over 60 million unemployed people right now in the United States. And now the Congress just took off till past Labor Day and completely neglected to do any more stimulus package whatsoever. And I'm not even one that believes in stimulus packages, whether it's for the corporate fucking assholes at the top or for regular human beings, until if you are taking someone's rights to work away from them, then you need to give them money. And if you don't give them money, then they have the right to respond in whatever way that they think is justified. Because what you're doing is every bit as fucking criminal as what they're going to do in response. And that's a very frightening thing, because we have a lot of people in this country that are going to get very desperate real quick. And they're going to do some really fucked up shit in order to survive. And unfortunately, I feel like the powers that be want that to happen so they could practice their little bullshit military weapons on the populace. Like, this is their, this is like their real video game in real life that their little dicks are just pulsating to get the chance to exercise. And it's really scary, because the idea that fellow citizens can harm fellow citizens based on the orders of some pukey, pasty-faced lackey in a cubicle somewhere is really inconceivable. And I think at some point, the powers that be need to take assessment of the fact that not everybody in the military is a mindless drone, and they join the military for their love of the country. And their love of the country comes from their love of their fellow human beings. And if push comes to shove, they're gonna stand on the side of their fellow human beings before they are the people that are trying to order them to massacre their fellow citizens.
The situation
it's insane to me that we're even having this conversation.
We have this, yes. The situation, I think, okay, I just want to say, I want to mention maybe one thing to this, but then maybe let's talk something else. But I want to say something to this. I guess it will not come to the situation where the Americans, soldiers, have to force the population to take any drugs. Because on the Economic Forum of Davos, which is in Switzerland, this is the club of the billionaires. There you can see that the World Health Organization has the intention to establish a World Health Organization force group or force army. And this is something where you can, and if you think further and you think about this kind of game, this means they will bring international force members to different countries who have no connection to the population.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I've heard about this for years. And to be honest, I used to laugh about it because I would hear this from my far right wing friends who would say, oh, you know, a communist fucking Bolshevik revolution is coming and they're going to take UN troops and put them in American cities and take away American sovereignty. And this is crazy. And people like Alex Jones would go on and on about this. And everybody would laugh and snicker and think that these guys were nuts, me included, because I really did not think that this could ever happen in the United States. And here we are sucking the dick of the World Health Organization and allowing them to dictate our day-to-day life and policies. And it's pretty creepy. And that's why it's funny to me when my fellow little Q following friends think that there's some wonderful agenda behind the scenes. And no, there's really something else happening. And trust me, Trump's on this. Like, dude, if Trump was doing anything positive about these pedophile motherfuckers, he'd be bragging about it left and right. He can't keep his mouth shut about anything. Not shit is happening on behalf of the American people right now. We are fucked. We've been sold down the drain by both the Republicans and both the Democrats. And here we are in a situation again where the country's been screaming about anti-police brutality, anti-police brutality. And now they're putting two motherfuckers that are more responsible for black men in prison unjustifiably over the last several years. And Biden, who's been fighting to ban Social Security for over 40 years. So we have a prosecutor cop lackey at his side, and we've got this dementia-ridden buffoon. This is the best that the Democratic Party can give the American people. Like, are you kidding me? What in the hell is going on? And that, oh, but this time we have to stand together and vote Democrat because we can't take the risk of losing to Trump again. This is what they say every election. They put bullshit, worthless politicians who don't give a flying shit about human beings and our daily plight, and they expect us to vote for them because the other side is super evil and we can't let the other side win because if the other side wins, looks what happens, blah, blah, blah. Then they all think magically that if Trump wasn't in office, everything would be just wonderful. And I don't even know how to have a conversation with these people. I mean, of course Trump is repulsive and his vernacular is absurd and he's the most comical, absurd caricature of a so-called leader one could possibly ever envision. But is that all you have to talk about 24 hours a day and to have your entire world so focused on hating one human being that you're willing to vote for two other piece of shit worthless assholes?
This has a system. Because as long as the focus of the people is in the direction of these subjects, they will not get strength again. I had today a very good conversation with a colleague of us. Zahi Gries he's an Iraqi guy who lives in Australia, and he said his intention is that people who are in the lockdown become out of the lockdown stronger than ever. And he said something wonderful. He said, if you take four subjects, for example, if you take the subject spirituality, your financial situation, your family and friends situation, and your physical conditions, the physical health. And then you rate from 1 to 10 every day, the next 30 days, how you are doing concerning your spirituality, how you are doing concerning financially, how you are doing concerning with your friends and families, how you are doing with your health. And if you get a figure of 4 or 5, then you have to find a way to improve it.
It's a great, great advice.
And this is something, and they want us to get weak.
Yeah.
It was so funny when I don't fly and I don't have a pilot license, but I like planes. And there was one time when there is a PC-12 from a Swiss company, which I like very much. And then I found out where it was. And this was also used by the American Army, by special forces. And the special forces, they had a slogan. And the slogan was, you can run, but you will always die tired. And this is a very interesting sentence. And I found this slogan by looking for, well, where is this plane used? But okay. And the funny thing is, this is true. And what this is all about is to make us tired. But if we got stronger out of these things again, then we are not tired and then they cannot kill us.
Yeah, of course. Well, we have a lot of people dying of suicide in epic levels that has never been seen before.
Yes.
And of course, you know, that comes down to both the isolation as well as the economic toll people are taking. There are people who base their entire reality on a career. And when that career's taken from them and they don't know how to just change course, these are fucked human beings, and it's very sad, and it's very wrong, and I'm heartbroken to see what I see happening. Like, the amount of harm they are causing while they're claiming to be trying to protect our health, which anyone knows is so obscenely, infantilely absurd, that you think the government cares about your health. I mean, give me a break. I it's so absurd, it's not even worth commenting on. But where were we?
Let me add this. It is already, everything is already experienced. In 70, or let me think, let me say 90 years ago, 87 years ago, the people here in Germany tried the same, but this time it was not the health which was the problem, it was the security of the population against the communism, socialism, people who had specific opinion and could be dangerous for the society.
Yeah,
and this was the same way how it started. Yeah,
we must ban all centers of social engagement. We cannot let the people talk together. This is very dangerous. It must be stopped.
Yes. 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 Yes, and no interconnection, no communication, no commitment.
Yeah.
This is the most scary thing.
That's a societal fabric. Yeah.
This is very interesting, and this is, for example, very interesting for our podcast, because here, although we are working in a group, but we can expand the group by people who have the, well, quite same mindset. Yeah. And who wants to enjoy a whiskey and want to laugh again.
Yeah. And you know what's sad, man, is there are tons of people that are having these Zoom happy hours. Like, I'm sorry, I absolutely refuse to get in front of a stupid ass computer and raise a glass with a bunch of heads on a screen. It's batshit crazy. No fucking way. There's no exchange of energy. There's no human element to it at all. I will get on Zoom to chat with a dear friend who I haven't seen in forever, because hey, that's a great medium and it's better than holding up your phone in front of your face. But I'm not going to get involved in some kind, you know, some weird, replaced creepy medium for human connection via a recorded, don't forget recorded, Zoom meeting with a bunch of people. It's really insulting to one's soul. And yet I know a lot of people in my industry who are doing this every week. And I don't know if they're doing it because they're being instructed to do it by, you know, the powers that be, and it's part of the marketing and keep this interest and spirits going, or if they really think this is a suitable substitute for getting together with people and raising a glass in person. Like, I don't know, but it's really weird and it's really dark.
Another social problem is what I found out is you can get close to the people who are far away by all this media stuff. But on the other hand, you get far away by people who are very close to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's no communication and there's no argument. The people do not like to argument anymore. And this is for me very scary, because if you are, for example, in a village and there would be no internet, the people would have to live together anyhow, and they have to live to communicate together anyhow. So this means if there are people with different opinions, they will have arguments, maybe they will have fights, but they will have still a commitment to each other. And this is completely gone, because the people, it's a question of happy life addicted, or the happy life junkies. Yeah, if they don't accept the situation which is close to them, then they go into the internet and find people all over the world who have the same opinion. But this is not good, because the situation is you need the commitment inside your village.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they divide us without doing anything. And this means if this is very black, this is very dark, dark vision, they come to you, they catch you, and no one cares.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's definitely part of the intention of the division of the citizenry. And you can see it coming. And I can tell you there are people on both sides, say the mask situation, the people that are, you know, insanely pro-mask and those who are insanely anti-mask, both sides would happily see the other side dragged off at this point. I really feel that way. It's gotten that crazy. And I don't understand it, that something as simple and innocuous as a fucking face mask can divide the people as deeply as it has. But again, it's that fear. They're projecting 24-hour fear on people. And because people are scared, they're easy to be manipulated. They're easy to be put into the fight or flight mode where they have this like omnipresent state of everyone has to have a mask in it. And there's no talking reason whatsoever. So I don't understand it, but I also don't understand the people who create a major scene in a grocery store because they don't want to wear a mask. I'll be very candid and say,
what is about in the United States about a medical certificate? For example, if you get a medical certificate that you're not allowed to wear a mask, is that possible?
I think that it depends on each municipality and, of course, the rules that have been planted down from the corporate owner of these grocery stores. The thing is, if somebody wants to go out without a mask, there's a million mom and pop markets where you can go get your groceries and do so. And so just do that. Otherwise, if you're going into a mainstream grocery store, don't give the people there a bunch of shit because they're asking you to wear a mask. They're only asking you to wear a mask because the fucking health department told them they have to tell people to wear a mask and they can get fines if they don't make people wear a mask.
In Germany, 25,000 euro. €25,000 if someone enters your store and someone is not wearing a mask, then you have sold something to him.
Yeah.
At that moment, 25,000 euro. Yes.
So if you're going to go in that store, just wear the fucking mask and then take it off the minute you get out, like any sane human being would do. Nobody sane walks around in the open air with a mask on. Nobody sane drives in the fucking car with a mask on.
But if you America, here in Spain and in South France, the people have to wear masks if they are outside.
Well, they have that rule here too, but nobody follows that shit. I mean, nobody. Oh, well, actually, I shouldn't say nobody. I do see people following it, but I see a lot more people not wearing it. If you're going out jogging, you're walking, it doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're outside walking in the open air and you're wearing a mask, you need to see a fucking psychiatrist, in my opinion. And
yeah, but the situation, this is, of course, in my opinion as well, but this is the rule in Spain and South France.
Well, then I would leave those fucking countries real quick.
Yeah, but it's not so easy. And the people, but yeah, it's...
I can't say I would never go outside because I'm not going to violate my health to spite a corrupt bullshit government. I mean, we all know the importance of vitamin D for one's health, period. Like it's imperative. And we know the importance of fresh oxygen, and depriving oneself of oxygen is never beneficial on any level whatsoever. Oxygen is as imperative to us as sunlight is to a fucking plant. Like, give me a break. Like, it's mind-boggling, Armut. It really is. I can't believe where we are as a people and how so quickly people have acquiesced to dehumanizing themselves. It's that kind of shit keeps me awake, wondering why are people so disconnected? Why are they so easily brainwashed? I don't understand it.
Because because they are in their routine, and this routine has never taught them to work, to deal with danger.
Well,
in my opinion.
Yeah, because, of course.
If you have enough money, or if you have learned to manage your life with the money what you get, and then every month you pay your bills, every month you save money, you can collect something, you can do something or anything like that. Not small steps, but some steps. In that moment, you're on your very big routine. You never need to become creative in order to survive. And if you never become creative in order to survive, you don't need the perception to see danger.
Yeah, it's probably why there wasn't mass chaos in the Soviet Union when they collapsed, because the people were already used to bartering and struggling to survive and relying on their local communities. I mean, if the government here collapses, whoo, man, it's going to be mass chaos. Like, and everyone's armed too. So Mad Max for real.
No, I don't think so.
I don't know.
No, I don't think so, because I saw it, for example, during the demonstrations, there were some cities where you had neighbor forces, and they take a look for their inhabitants, and this was very impressive. And I think this will happen as well in the U.S. because in that moment, all the villages will take their own responsibility. This is, I have never been to the state. This is only my theory. And then if they take their own responsibility, and as they have weapons, they know what to do. I've heard about a very interesting thing, because in 2019, 1,001 person were shot by the police in the U.S. And I heard about a neighborhood which has trained itself when the police came. This means the police knocks at your door. The owner of the house rings a neighbor, and then all the neighbors stand with guns directly focusing on the police.
Good. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I am not at all anti-police. They absolutely serve a purpose, but I'm also very aware of the fact that many, many innocent people are murdered by police every year. And I don't mean people creating a scene and arguing and fighting with the cops where shit escalates into this kind of situation. I mean people that are asleep in their fucking house and they storm in the wrong house and shoot these people dead.
Yes.
Or, you know, there was a guy the other day, I don't know this guy, a friend of mine posted something that they knew this fellow who died, and it was some guy in Albuquerque who had people break in his house at 2 a.m, and he shoots the people, and he calls the police to report it, and then this guy winds up dead. Like, what's that about? And I mean, this kind of thing happens all the time in the United States. And at some point, there does have to be more accountability for police. And I understand they have a very difficult job, and I do not take that away. I would not want to be an officer, and I would not want to deal with belligerent, drunk, drugged up people. Not even to mention just crazy ass motherfuckers that scream in their face and go nuts. But there's a lot of scumbag piece of shit, got seized their whole life in school, police officers who have little dicks and big egos and something to prove and giant chips on their shoulder. And that's a terrible thing for the honorable policemen and women out there who are just trying to uphold the law and do a job that they saw as a noble way to, you know, instill order, or maybe follow their family's tradition of law officers, or whatever the case might be. it taints them all with a bad name, and that's not good. And so I do think reform needs to happen desperately. And I even think that some of the shit that they're talking about with refunding some of the funds so that police officers aren't forced to be psychologists and let people who handle mentally ill people handle mentally ill people, because a cop with a gun drawn on some guy who is autistic is a dangerous situation. A guy who's highly, or some guy who's like epileptic or whatever the case might be. There's all kinds of situations where in heat of the moment, police respond in a way that may not be the best response to the situation. And this is not to say that if you have a raving crazy lunatic on drugs that is threatening harm to people that you send in social workers, because that's a fucking joke too. But we have to find some balance in how we deal with this. And the more fucked up and decayed society gets, the harder the job of being a police officer is. I mean,
so for example, here in Germany, and 2019 was a normal year. In Germany, we have per year between 12 and 20 people who are killed by police. But we are 80 million, and you are 400 or 320?
Yeah, something like that.
So maybe four times, okay, if you calculate on the fourth time. So we, with respect to calculation, we would have 60 people killed in one year. But this is also the reason why the Germans are not allowed to have weapons.
Right.
We don't, and this is a reason, and it's so much paper, and for a policeman to shoot one bullet is so much paperwork that he doesn't want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder what the rate is in England, because I know those cops are rarely armed unless it's some major development as well.
I don't know. UK, I don't know. It's UK got concerning this crazy situation. They have more strict and more tough rules than we have in Germany. This is nearly going crazy. But the situation is, well, I think there's also resistance. But, in my opinion, the only thing what we can do is like what we do right now. We can talk about it. We can make the people aware. We can give information so that people are able to make a decision. The most problem is if they are not able to make a decision. And then if people make a decision, then they can start to do actions. Anyhow, words, actions, management, doesn't matter.
Yeah. But
at the moment, we are in the phases where the people have to make a decision where and what they want to have in future. And
unfortunately, the majority
to have a bar and to have fun. I would love to have my own to be a retailer for whiskey. I think this would be a really cool job. This would be really, yes, you brought me to an idea. I want to become when I retire.
And Germans love good whiskey too, so you're in a good market. it's not like you're selling whiskey in some part of the world where that thing is not enjoyed. So yeah, why not, man?
Why not?
Cute little shop and only carry really good stuff. If you need any help, let me know. I can certainly guide you accordingly.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, of course.
Sounds good. But at the moment, okay, yeah, that's another good for the ending. For example, people ask, I have to stay at home. Yeah, and the problem is you stay at home, you don't have a good atmosphere at all. Yeah, and you get depressed, and maybe the most people are single. And do you have any recommendation how they can create a good atmosphere, and for example, how they can try to celebrate life with a good, really good drink? Because at home they start to drink beer or to start to drink wine or water, and that's it. so that they get a feeling for a good quality of life again.
Well, I would advise people to try to create the same type of ambiance that they would create if they were having a party and they were inviting over friends and they wanted to create the ultimate atmosphere that would make people happy, festive, and connected. So whatever that is for your individual aesthetic is the route I would pursue. Like for me, having some nice incense of some type burning, like could be something as mundane as Nag Champa or something beautiful like Palo Santo, or you could burn some sage and just create this nice cleansing of the air, have some candles lit or some little lanterns, because changing the light ambiance does make a difference in the energy of the room, period. And then putting on music that is uplifting and positive. You know, I found that reggae music has really served me well during this time because it's so bountifully positive in its energy frequency, and it's hard to be depressed when you're listening to fucking reggae.
Okay,
you know. But it's certainly not the only thing that I listen to, but it's really, I mean, man, it's done wonders for kind of transporting my senses to somewhere in the Caribbean, perhaps. And music is good for that. So, and then, treating yourself to a really nice beverage during times like this, I think is a good idea. I've always kind of snickered at the notion of treat yourself, you know, like, whatever, I guess I'm just spoiled because I've been surrounded by really good wine and spirits for decades. So sitting down to enjoy a rare beverage isn't like some transformative moment for me. But whatever, I would say like the ritual behind creating a really nice cocktail, maybe one that you're not familiar with, is a nice exercise to engage in because you're doing something you've never done before. You're learning a new cocktail that can have relevance. It's something you could teach your friends and you can make in the future, and you can enjoy other people's interpretations of them in different bars and restaurants if we're ever treated like human beings again. And breaking out a blender and making your own margarita at home or making your own pina colada, just go buy, and don't buy some bullshit coconut puree in a globby fucking container that looks like something out of Applebee's. Like get some actual coconut milk and put it in your blender with some rum and some good raw cane sugar and some fresh squeezed lime. Again, not some processed, dead, denatured garbage lime in a can or in a bottle, but fresh lime juice. And take the time to make something really delicious and raise a glass and enjoy the atmosphere. And more importantly, have somebody over. Don't do this alone. No ritual alone is, we're alone enough during all this. So definitely make some drinks for some friends, have a couple people over and connect and enjoy, and maybe try to do one really vital thing. And that is not talk about COVID-19 for at least, the first 2 hours you're together. Promise just not to talk about it. Don't give it energy. Don't give it attention.
Correct.
Talk about things that uplift your spirit, and don't even acknowledge it, because that's another thing that I think they want, and it lowers your fucking vibrational frequency to this base element that you don't want to be in. So think about, share like positive stories from the past and travels you've had, and talk about shit you want to do in the future, and just keep the negativity off the plate, because no matter what, we all have to deal with that on some level day to day. And so it may be therapeutic to vent a little bit with friends, maybe like for the first 15 minutes you get together and hug the shit out of each other and then change the subject and enjoy the atmosphere. Because, if you plan proper proper ambiance and atmosphere, being at home is not always the worst thing in the world. I mean, I know a lot of people who thoroughly enjoyed the 4 month lockdown, to be honest with you. They made the most out of it. They dug in and they created some amazing shit, whether it's artists or writers, or other content creators. Some people really took advantage of it and made the most of it. And in that same note, I'm glad that you and I were one of 100-something people who decided to take that Broadcast Yourself course, because I can say personally, it kept my mind focused on looking forward, and not focusing on the moment and digging into shit that's not corrupt, crooked governments and creepy little weasels trying to push vaccines on humans so they can make billions of dollars off a bunch of frightened.
I agree 100%. If we can create our own future and we kick the rest in the backside, then that's it.
Yeah.
Then this is how I said, you have to do what you love to do.
Amen.
Robert, it was a pleasure talking to you. It was really fun again.
Yeah. We already did this before, ladies and gentlemen, but then we said, that shit got too dark. We have to do another version. Let's do a follow-up. And here we are. It got pretty dark again, but oh well, this is a keeper. Go with it.
Okay. Robert, I wish you all the best, and also for your bar and for your podcast. We haven't talked about your podcast. Oh my God. We haven't talked about your podcast. Raise your glass. Hey, come on. Okay, come on. We have to give me 5 minutes more. Okay.
Sure.
You have this podcast, of course. It's so crazy. And in this podcast, you are already inviting CEOs and company owners who are producing very tasty spirits, and you give them the chance to explain the situation or to explain the environment in which they live and how they produce it, and give the people a small clue about what your podcast is about, because it's delicious like the things you have told about your bar. I already know it, but please go ahead.
part of the enjoyment of owning a bar is the ability to turn consumers on to really beautifully made products that are created with integrity and authenticity by providers or producers who I respect. And now that I'm unable to do that, I mean, I could still, feature their products and our drinks, but it's a very different element and atmosphere, as we've already discussed. We can't do like big tastings and product launches and parties and things of that nature. So the podcast to me is a way of continuing that work of exposing people out there in the airwaves to really beautifully made artisanal boutique distillates and fermented goods and non-alcoholic items such as coffee and kombucha and coconut water, whatever the case might be, different producers of different segments of beverage categories that are all made well and with good intent. So that's really what it's about. And it's also kind of speaking not only about the generalities of their product and how they're made, but going just a little deeper than your standard media company would do in their questions of like talking more about their personal experiences and their personal journeys and aha moments with their senses that I don't think they get asked quite as much as just the typical cursory glance at the product and the category and how it's made and where it's available. Try to go a little deeper and talk about the culture from where the particular product is created and how it ties in, and then the travels before this person got into the brand that they're currently involved in, you know, what got them there and, you know, what things they might be envisioning for themselves down the road and any other relevant subject matter, just on the human perspective and human connectivity and, you know, the joys and the rituals of raising a glass with the right company and the right place and the right time with the right food and the right music and the right ambiance, and the way that a really good drink can take you somewhere else from the present moment and kind of dig you deeper into yourself and just cause you to think and engage your senses, because at the end of the day, we're human beings and we're all about taste and sense and sound and smells, and a really well-made distillate is filled with a multitude of aromas and really complex flavors, and they kind of warrant some respect and digging in and really appreciating them and acknowledging them for what they are and what they can do as a people.
Perfect. No, that sounds brilliant. I'm looking forward to listen to it. I told you that I listened to one or three audios already, or what you have made, and this was really, you have the feeling you were in South America. It was unbelievable.
Oh, you listened to the Chacal.
Chacal, yes.
Yeah, that was a really good one. Seb and Ben both are very passionate fellows, and you can tell their love of what they do in that podcast. It's very present, and it makes you want to go to Patagonia instantaneously, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, it's also in the pronunciation, how they speak and how they really describe the situation. And this is you got it. Yeah,
definitely one of my favorite podcasts.
Yeah.
But they all have a special place in my heart. But that one I really like, because just Sebastian is infectious. His love of Patagonia is truly infectious. It makes you want to jump in his mind. And I feel that it gives you a little, you know, glimpse into his mind. And Ben as well, you know, they're both great partners for what they do. And they both just, to the best of my knowledge anyway, seem to work together absolutely brilliantly and cohesively. They have a common goal, and they're both very, very passionate people. And again, to me, that's what makes the difference between a good product and a mediocre shit product, is passion behind the people. Are you just trying to, I don't want to go dark, so I'll stop there.
It's okay. Well, no. So ladies and gentlemen, if you are more interested in this kind of subjects, if you want to listen more to about good spirits, how they are produced, where they are produced, and how it feels you really can feel the taste, or you can really taste it by the radio, please go to the podcast of Robert. Raise your glass.
And
raise your glass, and please enjoy it and have a wonderful time. Robert, I thank you very much for this interview as well. It was brilliant again, in my opinion. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk very soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.